Welcome everyone to the final event of the 2012 Johns Hopkins University Foreign Affairs Symposium. At this time, I ask you to please silence your cell phones. The Foreign Affairs Symposium is an entirely student-run speaker series featuring distinguished global leaders. We seek to stimulate intellectual dialogue about pressing international issues by inviting prominent speakers to the Johns Hopkins campus. This year's symposium is entitled The Paradox of Progress: Chasing Advancement Amidst Global Crisis. As the world becomes increasingly complex, many of the functions that yield advancement also expose new vulnerabilities. Many technological innovations bring along with them a slew of challenges to security, economic stability, equality, and human rights. Tonight, we invite you to take a deeper look into this paradox of progress. Former White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs has been a longtime advisor to President Barack Obama. Before his position as press secretary from 2009 to 2011, Mr. Gibbs served as an advisor and strategist to President Obama from his 2004 Senate race through his presidential campaign in 2008. Mr. Gibbs joined Barack Obama's 2004 U.S. Senate campaign as communications director and held the same title at the onset of the 2008 presidential campaign until becoming senior strategist for communications and messages during the general election. The Washington Post explains, one of the most impressive parts of President Barack Obama's massive 2008 presidential campaign was a surprisingly low number of leaks and campaign infighting. Credit Gibbs. On November 22, 2008, after 4 years of intense campaigning and close contact, Mr. Gibbs became an integral part of President Obama's administration. Mr. Gibbs was announced as a press secretary of the Obama administration and assumed the position on January 20, 2009. Prior to White House press secretary position, Mr. Gibbs also served as press secretary of John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign and has previously specialized in Senate races. Mr. Gibbs served as communications director for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, as well as four individual Senate campaigns. He was also the press secretary of Representative Bob Etheridge. The 2012 Foreign Affairs Symposium invites you to take a deeper look into the paradox of progress through Mr. Gibbs' speech. We ask you to please wait until the question and answer session following his speech to present any comments you may have. It is an honor to present to you tonight, Mr. Robert Gibbs.
Good evening. So we've got a lot of topics I want to go through tonight, and it's in a lot of disparate forms. And most of all, I enjoy the opportunity to speak, particularly on college campuses, because don't tell this to my friends that I used to work with, but I think generally in college campuses, you get better questions than I used to get in my day job. So I want to try to leave as much time as possible to hear what's on your minds, to hear your perspectives, and to have you ask questions, like I said, ranging from whatever you can conjure up. I'm used to answering crazy questions, so I will certainly do my best. I also like being invited to speak on college campuses because I remember when I was applying to go to school when I was 18, I didn't always get invited to the college campuses that I get invited to now. So that's I need to call my dad and tell him tonight I'm at Johns Hopkins. Next week I'm at Stanford. All the universities he never thought he'd hear me say. So I want to talk a little bit, first of all, in the beginning of this, just a little bit about what it's like to work in that building and to be the press secretary. Spend a little bit of time talking about the presidential race. Talk a little bit about the paradoxes internationally, and I think in a decent amount in our own domestic politics that I think we have got to figure out how to work through and solve over the next several years, because the problems that our country faces, regardless of your political perspective, are mounting each and every day. And then I said, I want to give you guys a chance to ask as many questions as you can. So before I tell you and overly romanticize the 2 years that I had as press secretary to the president, let me give you a sense of what that experience was like, both its ups and its downs. I'll start sort of at the end, ironically. Take, for instance, how one website covered the story of my announcement in January of 2011 that I would leave the post of press secretary for the President of the United States. The headline seemed like a rather ordinary story. It read simply, "White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs to step down next month." Fairly innocuous enough. But it was really the story's lead paragraph that struck me as significant. Quote, "Robert Gibbs, the nation's highest paid kindergarten teacher, will resign in February." True story. Another true story, from time to time, White House staffers get mail sent to them. I'm on TV, obviously, a lot as the former White House press secretary. I garnered a little bit more mail. So one day, between meetings, I sort of ambled out of my office and stood in front of my special assistant's desk, thumbing through a stack of this mail. And quickly, my assistant, Marissa, said, as I picked up what I thought was a standard-looking postcard, and she quickly said, "Don't read that," which made me more curious. And stubborn as I am, I quickly said, "Well, why not?" and began to read it. Maybe I should have known that no return address, no greeting, no salutation might have indicated that the postcard wasn't full of inspiration and positive feedback. On the back of that postcard were just a few handwritten words. It read, quote, "If you lost 40 pounds, you'd be a skinny buffoon." True story. I am happy to report to you tonight, the postmark was not from Baltimore. I'm also happy to report that now that I'm no longer surrounded by what seemed like an unending supply of red, white, and blue presidential M&Ms, that I seem to consume with some regularity over a 25-month period, that I can tell the writer of this unsigned postcard that I am about 15 pounds closer to the auspicious title of skinny buffoon. But seriously, for all the criticisms and for all the tough moments, public service and working in the White House over those 2 years was nothing short of a lifetime's dream and the highest honor. To take part in the governing of this country during what I think any person from any political stripe would agree were some of the most remarkable and challenging times in our nation's remarkable and challenging history. To see some of the events that I was able to see up close each and every day is an experience that I will never, ever forget. Ironically, I kept that postcard on my desk for the rest of my days at the White House to try to ensure in myself a little humility. Often people have asked me what was it like to walk down into that briefing room the very first day, lights shining, seats filled, and most of all, hard questions sure to come. And I remember that first time walking down from my office, down the hall, down the ramp, through the doors, out into a room that honestly is much, much, much smaller than it looks on TV. I was thinking about how nervous I was. As I would each day, I worked there, I'd spent several hours getting ready to answer those questions, hoping I wouldn't be stumped without an answer to an obvious question, or worse yet, knowing the answer and nonetheless giving it wrong. We were talking at dinner about, I remember in the middle of my first briefing, I remember a voice inside my head saying, "I can't believe I'm really doing this." And then another voice saying, "Focus on the question." And you know when reporters come with tough questions, they're seated in rows like this, and all the TV guys are in the front row, and if they think they've got a really hard question, they come in their TV makeup. And you can spot them sitting right there on the front row. I briefed the press in that room 250 times in 2 years, countless other times on Air Force One or in foreign countries all over the globe. And I can say without a doubt, each and every day I'd open my email or the newspaper or watch the news on television and groan audibly, shoulders slumping, that some story needed to be better explained, answers given about what our policy decisions were, and why we had made the decisions we made. There were many things that we had to deal with. You know these. In January of 2009, as we walked into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, I don't have to remind you, the country faced circumstances unlike any that we'd seen since the Great Depression. We were facing nothing short of an economic calamity. Our GDP was plunging. We were losing 700,000 jobs a month, 8 million in a recession before the recession officially ended. It was said and done. We had, and we still have, a housing foreclosure crisis. Banks weren't lending because many had no idea what their own exposure to toxic assets was. Two icons of the American auto industry, General Motors and Chrysler, faced bankruptcy, and at stake were another million jobs. But even before things collapsed in September of 2008, we had seen many years of wages for the middle class staying the same or declining. We'd watched manufacturing jobs disappear as technology required fewer and fewer workers to accomplish the same thing. A college education became more vital to succeed and more expensive to get. Healthcare was a luxury fewer and fewer could afford. And despite all the talk, we were more and more dependent on other places for our energy. Our fiscal state of affairs was a mess. And that's without mention of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan or security threats in Iran, North Korea, and Yemen. I think it's one of the first things you learn when you walk into and work in that White House. And that is that the hardest things you have to deal with are not simply the most obvious ones in front of you. Your day gets inordinately complicated by what you least expect. Remember pandemic flu, North Korean missile launches, a terrorist plot on Christmas Day? Just as we thought the economy would take off and recover 2 years ago, Europe gets hit by a debt crisis. In early 2011, no one could possibly have imagined what we would see and witness throughout the Middle East as a result of the Arab Spring. I remember just about 2 years ago, actually just about 2 years ago now, I remember being told that an oil rig 50 miles off the coast of Louisiana had exploded and 11 people were dead. No doubt a tragedy if the story ended right then and there. But it was what unfolded in the days and the weeks, and in this case, months ahead, that was hard to predict that very first day. 2 days after the explosion, the rig collapsed and sunk to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Oil leaked from a mile below the water's surface. A week later, late in the day, we got word in a meeting in the Chief of Staff's office that the situation was far worse than we thought. The blowout preventer wasn't going to stop oil from leaking. Those leaks were greater in number and coming from more places than we predicted. From the Situation Room, we phoned the president aboard Air Force One as he flew back to Washington from a trip to Iowa. The next day, we assembled what became known as the oil spill cabinet. We briefed the country on what we knew and what we were trying to do to get a completely uncontrollable situation back under control. For the next several months, the oil spill became the dominant issue we dealt with and something that took up hours of my day. Frankly, those were some of the very toughest briefings I ever encountered. There were no easy answers to this situation. And I have to tell you, I know more about the containment capacity of ships, the drilling and cementing of relief wells, the operation of a blowout preventer, than any person that doesn't currently derive a majority of their income from an oil company. Maybe it's a patriotic or talented four-star general in charge of Afghanistan who gives unfettered access to himself and to his team to a reporter. Just like the oil spill was nothing I'd planned on dealing with that day. Someone on my staff came into my office during the end of a meeting I was having and showed me an article that would soon be on newsstands from Rolling Stone magazine. The reporter had spent a week or so with General Stanley McChrystal and his team in Afghanistan. And some of what was said throughout the article was simply unflattering. I read the article and went immediately to see the chief of staff. Soon after that, I called the president in the residence and said, "Sir, I've got something I think you need to read right now." I walked over to the residence and handed him the rest of the article. And 10 minutes later, half a dozen of us were sitting in the Oval Office. Sometimes these unplanned events intersect. Just a couple of days after the article was seen by the world, the president made the tough decision to change commanders in Afghanistan. I remember standing off to the side of the Rose Garden that day, watching the president announce a change in leadership that would put General David Petraeus in charge of our efforts in Afghanistan. I remember slowly walking back to my office after the announcement, thinking of all that had transpired over a few tumultuous days. And I hadn't been in my office more than about 15 seconds when one of my staff came in and said, "Sir, we have a problem." I said, "Nick, no, we don't. We probably have 24. You see, after much work, the oil spill had finally improved. A device known as the top hat was put on the broken blowout preventer and was sifting oil into a containment ship for the first time. I told you I knew too much about the containment capacity. So finally, we were collecting a significant amount of the leaking oil. But a robotic camera had seemingly knocked the top hat off of the blowout preventer. And for the first time in weeks, oil was again uncollected and leaking unfettered into the Gulf of Mexico. I said, "Nick, if what you're telling me is a joke, somebody's going to get fired today." Unfortunately, all of it was true. So I walked into the Oval Office. President looked up from sitting at the desk reading, and I said, "Sir, it seems during the event in the Rose Garden, a robotic camera dislodged the collection device at the oil spill, and oil is again leaking into the Gulf of Mexico." Incredulous, the president stood up and said, "Well, why did it do that?" I said, "Sir, I have no idea, but I'm told they do not think it is too serious or anything more than temporary." But before I could finish, the president looked at me directly and said, "Gibbs, for the rest of the day, your only job is to make sure that no robotic cameras knock that thing off the oil well again. Do you understand?" The last 2 weeks I served in the administration, we again faced the unforeseen. And I talked about this for a second earlier, and it gets me into talking a little bit about your theme on the paradoxes of progress. What started in Tunisia when a vendor had his fruit taken and was slapped by a government official ignited events that no one possibly could have predicted, that ultimately spread across the Middle East region to Bahrain, Egypt, Yemen, Libya, and continues today even in Syria. I realized during those days how fortunate I was to be part of watching history unfold right in front of me. Those that wanted democracy to come to Egypt were watching what was said each and every day in America, and especially right there in the briefing room. The question and answer sessions I took part in were translated and beamed to millions across the globe. It was at that very end of my tenure that I realized what a remarkable and special privilege I'd been given, not simply to serve as a representative or a spokesperson for the president, but as a spokesperson for the country. But it was remarkable and unique to watch the interconnectedness of our world come together in Egypt and in Tahrir Square to unite first hundreds and then thousands and then millions of Egyptians in yearning for democracy, to pick their leaders and to pick their government. And I was thinking about this a little bit over the last couple days in what I was going to talk about tonight, and I was thinking about, many of you are probably too young to remember this, but there's a great political movie starring Robert Redford called The Candidate. And some of you remember it. If you haven't seen it, it's a wonderful movie, but there's this great scene at the end of the movie. I'll ruin it, but it's worth seeing because it's hard to tell this story without telling you the ending. But there's this kind of perfect person to run for office, and these political consultants find him. And he's not a great political candidate in the beginning, but he sort of blossoms into this role and becomes the kind of person that you'd want. And there at the end of the movie, he improbably wins the election and looks at the political consultants and says, "What now?" You still should see the movie, it's good. But I'm reminded, because in a place like Egypt or throughout the Middle East, as we've had this yearning for democracy, I bet very few Egyptians that were in Tahrir Square that day realized that that was the easy part. And now we've had that "what now" moment. It's a paradox in our foreign policy, right? For administration after administration, we looked the other way in some things that the Egyptian government did because we sought and needed stability in that region, and particularly along that border. We weren't altogether prepared for what we would see because, quite frankly, nobody could have predicted what we would watch happen and spread across all those different countries that quickly. 50, 60, 70 years of change happening in 50, 60, or 70 days. I think it's remarkable. The country has gone through, over the past probably 4 or 5 or 6 years, a real looking into the institutions in our country. Some of this reflection happened around what happened in Wall Street in 2008. Unfortunately, probably not as much of that reflection has happened on Wall Street. But I think virtually every major institution in this country has undergone some sense of change and reflection. And the truth is, what I watched as press secretary, both before I became the press secretary and in the campaign, was a remarkable evolution in our media and in our information. We are now more connected than we've ever been at any time. The amount of information that we have available to us will be exceeded only by what's available to you tomorrow, and the day after that, and the day after that. I talked to Marlon Fitzwater, who had my job in the Reagan administration and also for the first Bush presidency, and I remember after spending a few hours with him thinking, and certainly reflecting on this in the years after, how much the job had changed because of how much media and the information available had changed. You see, in 1980, in a country that was population-wise obviously smaller than what we have today, more than 50 million people turned on the news and watched one of the three nightly newscasts. I remember as a kid that sort of iconic music, the introduction of the news anchor, that in opinion poll after opinion poll, we're always considered among the most trustworthy people in our society. 50 million people in 1980 watched one of those newscasts. In a country that's now 80 million people bigger than 1980, about 21.5 million people watch one of those nightly newscasts. Yet we have more information available at our fingertips than we ever have before, right? It's ironic that you have to start a speech by telling everybody to turn off their phone, because it's not just a phone, right? It's a camera and a recorder, and the way most of us get our news now, whenever we want it. We don't have to turn on the TV at 6:30 Eastern time or 5:30 when I was growing up in Alabama to watch what happened during the day, because it happens on our phones every minute of the day. And I was thinking about the paradoxes and how that technology connects us and provides us a greater amount of information than we've ever had access to before. We are more connected, yet also more segmented than we might have ever been. The irony of the fact that with all this information and with all these facts, we're actually, I feel, more segmented in our beliefs than we ever have been. Our country is still remarkably polarized. You guys all have a lot of reading to do as a portion of your study, so you probably don't get a chance to, like I do now, get a chance to read for pleasure. But occasionally, if I don't have a chance to go to a bookstore, I'll go on Amazon and order a book. And there's this great little function, right? It says, if you liked Sarah's Key, you'll love these books. And conveniently, it lists 20 books that I can also hit and order. And I think it's interesting. I see a little of that impact in information and ultimately how it impacts our politics. The paradox of being more connected and more segmented, we're all watching what we already believe. The newscasts that we see each day are now, because we're not just relying on three networks, we have cable, we have the internet, blogs, and everything. I fear that at a time in which we probably need more than ever to understand the viewpoints of others, we tend each night to go home and watch something that re-emphasizes or strengthens the beliefs we already hold. And how much more difficult that is a barrier ultimately to having to sit down together and not give up on your principles, but understand some perspective of where the other side comes from. I think that is going to be a remarkable challenge in the next several years, regardless of who's victorious in November. We have a lot of big things that have to get done in this country. We have a lot of huge issues that sit on our plate and have to get taken care of. But if you watch, again, how connected we are, but also how segmented we are, you understand how hard that is going to be to overcome in order to make that progress. I was speaking to some PR executives in the fall up in New York, and I sort of offhandedly said, I think this is going to be the Twitter election. I think the speed in which information moves, the desire to stay super connected, to understand what's going on at a moment's notice and what might change the dynamic in a political debate or a policy debate. But if you think about it, even as we're connected, how many people can understand the political issue in 140 characters or less? I mean, let's be honest, if we could solve some of our most vexing problems in 140 characters or less, this would be a lot less exciting political election. It's hard to understand the nuance of a foreign policy issue or the complexity of a budget issue or financial reform in 140 characters or less. We're more connected, but we're more segmented. And the impediment that that's going to bring to getting us to be able to sit down one another with one another and actually decide some of these complex issues, I think is going to be one of the most remarkable challenges that we're going to have to deal with. Regardless of where you sit, I tell this to groups, I think is unique. It gives you a greater understanding of where they come from. And I think in the end, you get a better understanding of what we all agree on, segment with, but on TV, you're in these boxes. You're sitting next to each other. You could actually reach over and touch them. It would be an awkward thing on the screen. You just look like this weird hand. And I think in our politics and in our political discussion, I think we agree on more than we probably know, but we're all put in little boxes. So if you like Rachel Maddow like I do, try going home in the next week and watching something on Fox. Don't go crazy and watch Sean Hannity, but watch something. Watch something on Fox. And if you're used to watching Fox News, watch something on MSNBC. Decide there's an issue that you are genuinely interested in, and simply look for more information on a viewpoint that isn't one that you automatically brought to the table to begin with. I think if we begin to do a little of that, we'll have a better sense of understanding about where we agree and what sense of common ground we might have. I think it's one of the most unique challenges that we have in this. I watched the healthcare debate up close, obviously. 40% of the stories that were done by the news media during the healthcare debate, 40% of the stories were on the politics and the strategy of healthcare reform. Five times the number of stories that were actually done on the proposals for healthcare reform. And then I used to walk into the briefing room and somebody, one of those TV reporters, would say, "We have a poll. The poll says nobody knows what's in healthcare reform. Are you surprised?" No. Because we didn't have a debate about healthcare reform. We had a debate about the strategy of healthcare reform. And on an ancillary subject was what was in healthcare reform. It's a huge challenge, and it's a great paradox. And it's a great burden, I think, in some ways, on the progress that we have to make. I want to leave you with one point before I do questions to give you a sense of what's at stake in this election. I think this is going to be, I think this obviously is an extremely important presidential election. I think you probably have a sense of where I am. I tell this audience as though this is going to be a very, very close political election. In 2008, we had near ideal political circumstances. And if you listen to pundits, both on election night and then the days after, President Obama enjoyed what they all termed as a landslide, 365 electoral votes, almost 100 more than is needed to be president of the United States. And yet I'm reminded that in that landslide, we got exactly 53% of the vote. 53-47 was considered a landslide. This is going to be a very close political election. It's a consequential political election because we have so many things that we have to solve after that election. And this is the point I want to leave you with before we do questions. We have to, in this country, get about solving some of these problems. We cannot have a presidential election where the people that don't win the presidential election decide in the weeks after that presidential election that we're not going to do anything until the next presidential election. Because if we do that, you're going to be coming to a speaker, a forum like this, in 4 or 8 years, listening to a speaker like me talk about the very same issues that have yet to be solved. The only problem will be, we'll be 4 or 8 years behind in getting that solution. We have got to figure out how to sit down with each other and agree on some measure of things to make progress. And none of those will be easy. But let me give you a sense of what has to happen in about 60 days after the presidential election. 45 days after the presidential election. There's 45 days from the day after the presidential election there's 55 days in the presidential election, between the presidential election and the end of the year. Here's what happens at the end of the year if nothing happens. Every level of the Bush income tax cuts expire. The payroll tax cut expires. The elevated number of weeks of unemployment benefits and unemployment insurance expires. And the debt limit is likely going to have to be raised again in that 55 days. Those 55 days, as you might imagine, include Saturdays, Sundays, Hanukkah, and Christmas, and Thanksgiving. In the 15 days from New Year's to the 15th of January, two things will happen around one big issue. Unless we come to some agreement on our medium and long-term fiscal health and our path, $1.2 trillion in automatic cuts affecting healthcare providers and the Pentagon, the multitude of our problems and the magnitude of our problems can actually be solved by the citizens of our country. We have the capacity to solve these problems. We just have to decide it's what we want to do. Because it's not just those 70 days. There are tons of other issues that we have to get about solving. Or I think the very notion that we wake up each and every day in a country that passes to its children and its grandchildren a better way of life and a better living is not going to be so automatically accepted as it has been in the past. We have to make a series of conscious decisions that makes and ensures that the livelihood and the life we pass on to our children and our grandchildren is guaranteed to be better than the ones that we live in today. So with that, thank you, and let me take some of your questions.